to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So today's talk, I'm calling the practical value of awakening to the absolute aspect of reality. So next week, I am going to Sesshin, the week-long silent meditation retreat. And, you know, there's still stuff going on here. I think Jim and I are the only people going to Sesshin next week, so there's plenty of people will be here. Whenever I am going to go away to Sesshin, so I've been doing an average of probably two of these a year for about 25 years. And obviously I'm dedicated to the practice, but I always find myself reluctant to leave, reluctant to make the time. You know, as many of you know, I'm really into bodhisattva activity and taking action in the world, and the world is on fire and we need to be protecting our democracy, and there's a whole lot of stuff that we need to be doing in the world. And we have responsibilities, family, home, my garden, the Zen Center. It's just, you know, all kinds of things. Of course, we love spending time with our loved ones. I mean, yeah, it's just a week, but, you know, it's a week without my husband. It's a week without my doggies. And, you know, we want to enjoy our lives. Enjoy the things that bring us happiness and ease and allow us to express our creativity, etc. I mean, this is the only life we have, as far as we know, right? And when you go to Sesshin, you know, you give up a lot of that stuff. There's no reading or watching TV or playing in your garden or anything like that. So why set everything aside for a whole week? And for that matter, why the tradition of renunciation in Buddhism? So we have not just that we, you know, when we sit, we put everything aside for that period of time on the cushion. It's a sense of, you know, in microcosm, it's renunciation. And then if we do a retreat, and then there's also the, obviously, the tradition in Buddhism of monasticism, of people who dedicate their lives for a period of time or for their whole life to really set aside all of the usual pleasures of life for what? And as I'm going to talk about later, the monasticism in Buddhism is not, it's not so important that, obviously, that each of us act in the same way as in the monastic tradition. But what I find helpful about the monastic tradition, monasteries, monks, whatever, is there a physical enactment of what it is we're trying to do with our hearts and minds. So there's a saying in Zen called, there's monks of body and monks of mind. So the monks of body are literally enacting the renunciation and the focus and whatever, but all of us who are not, you know, and myself, if I'm not in a monastic environment, the idea is to be enacting that same thing in our minds and hearts. It may not be physically enacted, but so I'll kind of get into what all that's about. So I'm not, this talk isn't about emphasizing how you should attend Sesshin, although I would love you to. You know, because we're also make time and space in our lives for Zazen. We make time and space in our lives for, you know, coming to Sangha and other kinds of contemplative practices. So exploring today what renunciation, focus on contemplation, silence, stillness is about. And the gist of it is that it helps us awaken to the absolute aspect of reality. And doing that makes us stronger, more resilient, and more joyful in our lives as we go about our lives in the relative world. Because most of us, frankly, are, well, I don't know if attached is the right word, attached in a good way to our lives in the relative world. We're not interested in going off to a monastery and giving everything up forever. We want to be active in the world, have relationships, etc., do work, work for positive change, all that. So it's helpful to understand how putting everything down, how creating space, the contemplative practices, the trying to awaken to this other aspect of reality fits in our life, and how it's complementary. It's complementary to our action. It's complementary to our activity. So just to review, according to Buddhism and Zen, reality has two aspects. It's one reality, it has two aspects. And they are simultaneously true. They're not, they don't conflict. Just like, this is one of my favorite analogies, all analogies are inadequate at some level, but just the way that a finger is, you know, an independent thing. I mean, that's kind of by definition. It moves freely. It's not connected to the other fingers. That's how it functions, is that it's independent. So it is independent, and it's also only meaningful when it's part of a hand. I mean, a finger disconnected from a hand is, I mean, you only call it a finger because it used to be attached to a hand. Like, a finger separate from a hand is means nothing. So a finger simultaneously is independent and just part of a whole. So in that sense, like, our reality has these two aspects that are simultaneously true. They don't conflict with each other. They're simultaneously true. So one aspect in Chinese is called shi, S-H-I-H, or, well, it wouldn't have been spelled that way, of course. And that's the relative. It's the phenomenal world. It's the world that's the aspect of reality that we're familiar with, that is always obvious to us. It's the world of relationship, difference. You know, it's the finger being separate, contingent, conditional. Who I am is defined in part by who you are. It's all about relationship and interdependence. It's the aspect of reality in which there's individuality, action, cause and effect, good and bad, helpful and harmful. In the relative sense, it's useful to have concepts and labels and theories that help us predict what's going to happen and differentiate between things and make sense of things. The relative aspect of reality is wonderful and terrible, beautiful and tragic. It's everything. And then the absolute aspect of reality is Li, essential, ultimate oneness, sameness. This is much harder to get your mind around what this means, because you really can't get your mind around it. You can get your mind around relative stuff. You can't get your mind around the absolute aspect of reality. So, because language is a tool of the relative. Language can't really get at this very well, because language is about this versus that and defining that, and, you know, it's about describing the relative world. So all we can do in order to all we can do is point toward the absolute aspect of reality. You know, that thing you've heard, like the finger pointing at the moon. Like, if I'm pointing at the moon, my finger doesn't even represent the moon. It doesn't convey the moon, doesn't describe the moon, it doesn't substitute for the moon, but somehow it communicates something, and it might get you to also be able to experience the moon. So language is kind of, and so, you know, we use all different kinds of terms and techniques for pointing at this aspect of our reality. So I'm just going to point you do some pointing. So the absolute aspect of reality is the right here at this very moment aspect. And the moment, you know, the moment is ungraspable. I mean, we immediately want to, you know, in our relative minds, well, you know, this moment, this second, or this minute, or this, you know, we want to kind of measure it and grasp it. And this moment, this ungraspable moment, which is always receding beyond our grasp. But even though we can't grasp it, I mean, we don't have to grasp it. Our direct experience right here, right now, it doesn't have to be grasped or conceived or understood in a relative sense or by language. Just the fact that you can't, it's kind of like that, you know, when you say, like, when the arrow is going toward the target, and then it goes, you know, the distance is halved and halved and halved and halved and halved. And so how does it ever reach the target? It's like, well, I don't know, but it does. Like, you know, it just, our mental ability to grasp it is says that this isn't possible, but it is possible. So if the relative is about relationships reaching out through space and time, and I remember reading something. This was Kato Chisan, Roshi Kennett's teacher. I think it was something in his writing that he mentioned this, but I can't find it. Anyway, if the relative is about relationships reaching out through space and time, through dimensions, the absolute is the truth of our dimensionless, boundless, lively manifestations centered in our lower belly. Or kind of, I think Kato Chisan described it as kind of like the vertical. If the relative is the horizontal, but vertical without any, like, without any dimension. It's right here. And when we perceive this, Suzuki Roshi called this aspect of when we perceive this as things as it is. And we speculate, I mean, was it just his, you know, not so good English? But, I mean, actually that points to this exactly. Things as it is. So there's a multitude of things, and yet it's all one. So all phenomenal things manifest in the absolute, just as they are, just where they are, but as infinite parts of a vast unified tableau. It's all just part of what is. One thing. So this is desperate pointing, but it feels a little bit like it might, if you could like freeze the universe in time and then wander through it in three dimensions, just appreciating the constellation of phenomena at that particular moment for exactly what it is. You could just wander around and see how everything was, and just kind of a perfection of that moment. And in that aspect of reality, labels and concepts are irrelevant and unnecessary. Because those are all about defining and separating and differentiating. Boundaries and agendas similarly lose their meaning. It isn't one thing versus another, moving from this state to that state. It's just what is. And surprisingly, things as it is has a luminous, miraculous, and precious quality. Because it's utterly free from any expectation it should be otherwise. All measurements of good and bad and should and right and wrong, and you know, those are all in the relative aspect of reality. In the absolute sense, it is just what it is, and there's like the insufficiency of things as it is would only be relative to some expectation or ideal. And that just doesn't apply. And this preciousness is, because of that, is unconditional. Even the terrible things in the world are included and subsumed in it. It's just all included. So I'll explain in a bit why cultivating a sense of this aspect of reality is important. So in Sesshin, as well as in like monasticism and Zazen in general and our contemplative practices, it's setting us up to awaken to the absolute. Because this is hard to do in the midst of activity. And not because the absolute is obscure or transcendent or supernatural or out of the reach of ordinary beings. It's just that it's a subtle, often missed aspect of the reality we're always in the middle of, but we don't perceive it because of habit. Because, you know, the vast majority of our lives we've been caught up in the relative aspect of reality. And one of the things that we've done because of that is we've made a mental map of reality, of that relative reality. That mental map is for navigating this relative world, and we mistake that mental map for reality itself. We can't or won't let it go. And therefore we can't perceive we can't perceive reality really, but especially the absolute aspect of reality where that mental map just does not apply. So our mental map includes narratives about who we are, who other people are, how the world works, how our life is going, how we've been wronged, what we need to do next. It includes concepts about things like happiness, meditation, right and wrong, spiritual insight, the absolute. And these are the relatively easy aspects of our mental map to recognize and change our relationship to and maybe let go of at times. More challenging are the aspects of our mental map that seem to us absolutely foundational and essential. Our core values, our foundational beliefs, and even a basic sense of self. And even more subtle than that, even when those things are relatively light or we've kind of let go of them, our mind imposes a faint filter of interpretation, even over our immediate experience. Essentially this little like running commentary about how this moment relates to the unfolding of our life. And that's a very, very subtle aspect, but that even that level of a mental map keeps us bound to the relative aspect of reality. And we cling to our map. We're convinced that the universe and everything in it, including us, would like something would happen. We'd disappear in a puff of smoke. Everything would go to hell in a handbasket. For all we can tell, this is reality. We can't like just let go of this. I mean, who knows what would happen? This is why in Sesshin, we step away from involvement with our jobs, families, pleasures, projects. We forgo reading and writing, let alone computer use or keeping up with the news. I feel some trepidation about coming out of session next week and like, what the hell will have happened? If something really, really bad happens, they kind of let us know by inserting it in the, you know, when you do the chant and you have the dedication of merit. That happened once. I can't remember what it was, but I think they mentioned something in the dedication of merit that something horrible happened. But we put that aside. We minimize and simplify our activities, responsibilities, choices, decisions, social interactions. We don't even meet each other's eyes. We keep silence. And those of us who are lucky enough not to have any responsibilities during session beyond maybe like washing lunch dishes or something like that. We have no, you know, organizing responsibilities. Like we have no reason to think about anything. I mean, we may have preferences and think about things like, you know, how things could be done better, but ideally we don't have to do that. And so in the ensuing silence, we turn to face our minds, hour after hour, day after day. And the cruder aspects of our mental map, while compelling at first, gradually bore us, and we let them go to some extent, at least for time, brief periods of time. I mean, subtler aspects of our mental map keep us trapped for a while, but then for a moment, there's a lapse in our map. And we recognize in what way it's just a map. Because if you kind of just sit and watch your mind for 8 hours a day, for eight, you know, 7 days, and you're sleep deprived, and what, I mean, there's going to be a moment where the map kind of falls away for a moment. And there can just be a glimmer of that absolute aspect of reality where just kind of everything is complete. Right here, right now. You know, and in a way, this very place is without boundary, so it contains everything as well. You're kind of sitting with the whole universe, and it's just things as it is. So just to give this a little more of a concrete feeling, let's talk about what I expect my experience to be like next week. And every session is different, and it's best to not go in with any expectation. We often do anyway, but ideally. And so, you know, I'm prepared for it to be different as well. But pretty, you know, after like 50 sessions, there's kind of a typical pattern. So the first few days, I expect, will still be full of thinking. I will be thinking about the Zen Center and things I should do, and I think about blog posts and podcast episodes and climate change and what we should do about it, and, you know, like, so my mind will be doing all this stuff, and then, you know, you give me long enough. Oh, and then I'll also be like thinking about the plots of TV shows and whatever. You know, planning my garden. Oh, I didn't clean the gutters. I gotta do that when I get home. And then I'll find like, now I'm rewriting that blog post that I wrote earlier the day before. You know, like now I'm going over the same territory again. There's usually something of a hump day in session, most people find. Second or third day, maybe. I don't know. It's just, that doesn't always happen, but it's very frequent. It's just, I mean, you're tired, uncomfortable, in pain, just bored. I don't know. It's just, it's unrewarding, kind of miserable. I get really, really tired. I really need 9 hours of sleep a night to function at my best, and I get 6 at session if I'm lucky. But the interesting thing is that over the course of session, you need less sleep, I guess, because you're just sitting around all day. So that hump day is just kind of to be endured. And it's almost like in order to get over that, you just have to really surrender to the practice. Just and just stop worrying about how long you're going to be there, whether this is useful, what's happening. I mean, you know, because otherwise you'd just go crazy if you think about like 4 more days. Oh my God. So, you know, in a certain sense, it just, in order to get past that, you just surrender. And then I find that for me, my relative life, my relationships and activities and concerns and all that, it's like it kind of recedes. And then it becomes, it's still present, but it's like part of a bigger landscape. You know, it's just part. And I have a much bigger perspective. So things that are usually like, oh my God, you know, are like, I don't know. There's some space. And then there's certain moments, like I said, of just that. Just this, things as it is. Things being luminous and ordinary at the same time. You know, it may happen while eating a bowl of tofu at lunch or, you know, doing work practice. Just a moment of... And the ironic thing is that when we notice these moments, I mean, in a way, they're already gone, right? Because as soon as there's a concept of like, oh, yes, I am just here right now. Like, you know, now we have a mental map again. But I don't think this kind of mental map, and it's not an all or nothing thing. It's not, you know, we're attached to our mental map or, well, we're, you know, swimming in the absolute. We can let go of the coarser levels of that, of the narrative and the, you know, the concepts, and we can be settling down so our map is much, I don't know, maybe thinner or lighter or, you know, much more likely to just kind of lapse in certain moments, and then we perceive another aspect of reality. And when I get this sense, and I know many other people do as well, that in these moments, it feels like I'm awake, and most of the time I'm in a dream. There's a sense of those moments being somehow more real. And I think it, to some extent, it's because those moments, they contain and don't deny my experience the rest of the time. But they're something that the rest of the time I'm usually, you know, oblivious of. So I'm getting into why this is useful. I mean, you know, there's some merit in just like contemplative practices and insight and everything on their own, but for me, I kind of want to know why, you know, why is this useful? How does this relate to my life? How is this going to make my bodhisattva activity better or more effective or whatever? So this is what I'm looking forward to. This is why I'm taking a week, you know, out of my busy life to do this. At a certain point in the session, you know, I was saying like the relative kind of recedes, and my ordinary daily activities, whether they're personal or Zen Center related or out in the world or whatever, they start to look strangely and wonderfully optional. The kind of compulsion and worry that's involved in them, usually a sense of, you know, passionate right and wrong and must, and I don't know, that eases up. So it's not that things look unimportant. It's not that at that moment it's like, climate change, who cares? You know, 6th mass extinction. It's all perfect and precious anyway. That is pitting the absolute and relative against each other, and that's just not how it works. They apply at the same time. So even as, you know, there are many, many things in the world to address, and I will continue to address them. There's also this other aspect of reality. And that's when it makes sense to me. There is a line in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, the great wisdom sutras, and the Diamond Sutra, and the Prajnaparamita in 8,000 lines, and probably other ones as well, where it talks about how the Bodhisattva vows to save every last being. You know, and there's dramatic ways to put this, you know, like, kind of, and not just human beings, you know, born of this way and that way and in this universe and that universe, and all and any being the Bodhisattva is going to say is devoting him or herself to save every last one. However, in doing so, she does not conceive of a single being, does not conceive of herself as a being who is going to be doing saving or beings who are to be saved. And to me, I'd put this in terms of loving function does not require a mental map. That mental map I have of like, this needs to happen, that's unjust, and has a practical value in the relative world, but I don't actually need that. That if I'm attached to that, if I mistake that for reality, it actually gets in the way. And actually that loving function doesn't have to be dependent on any conception of a being. Another way to put it maybe is a bodhisattva is a grounded, ideally in an expanded awareness of reality that includes both of its aspects, relative and absolute. So in the absolute sense, the miraculous, luminous preciousness of life is untouched by the arising and passing away of whole universes. So this is part of the Buddhist like cosmology, is that and which actually fits pretty well with physics, right? Universes arise and pass all the time. And this deeper beauty, or whatever you want to call it, is untouched by that. It's within that. Universes arise and fall. And that truth, having a sense of that truth, a connection to it, provides strength and resilience and joy. And then at the same time, the miraculous, luminous preciousness of life only exists in manifestation. It is not a thing. It's not an ethereal thing that exists over here and then, you know, physical universes arise and pass and this ethereal thing isn't bothered. This precious thing, it doesn't exist except in manifestation. Therefore, everything that manifests is precious, is an emanation of this thing, of this truth. And so that truth then awakens compassion and energy for tireless service. So when we can do both of these, you know, and in a practical sense, for me, I notice, ideally I try to go to session twice a year. I mean, I'm fortunate in that I have the flexibility to be able to do that. Sometimes once, I mean, kind of like minimal once, but what I notice is that I think I'll be doing okay before session. I'll be like, fine. But then in the process of session, I'll see how I've lost sight of the absolute, how I've gotten, you know, caught up, how I've gotten a little lost and caught up in my mental map. And I know that makes me less effective and skillful, and it certainly makes me less joyful. It makes me more stressed. It makes me more You know, and when we're acting in that way, we're probably not going to be very, very effective. So anyway, I hope that there'll be a little, like, feels like kind of a reset, like a factory reset at Sesshin. And then I come out and I can pick up all my activities again. And then, like I said, this isn't just about Sesshin. I think it's a wonderful tool for that, because of all those ways that it removes all of your relative concerns, so that you really technically can let go of your mental map, because there's very few things that you need to decide or anything like that. So it encourages you to do that. But I mean, we make it whenever we make time and space in our life for zazen, for, you know, putting things aside, and even just as we walk around, just this intention to be aware of and, you know, awaken to, not be too attached to our mental map, hold the question of what else is there that I'm not seeing, all of that assists in this practice. So I'll leave it there. Questions or comments? Yeah?
Does anybody ever make it stop there?
I don't know. The people who've been to Sesshin, have you ever not made it past your hump day?
Does that mean me leaving?
Or like,
yeah. Or just miserable the whole damn time?
Yeah.
Mokuan says, okay. but that must have not, I mean, like a couple times?
No.
Or was it all the time?
No. You know, I just think I remember one session that was just profoundly difficult. And I just suffered through the whole thing. I could not come to the bright luminosity.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, but I think that's where, like, I was going to liken this to exercise in a way. Like, it's a healthy habit, but you don't go for a vigorous hike and then you're like, well, was that worth it? Do I feel really good now? I mean, you know, you realize it's like, you know, it's a over time kind of thing. So, yeah, I mean, people sometimes leave Sesshin, but I think it's pretty typical to be able to. I mean, I think what's most remarkable is that there's a hump day. Not that there's miserable Sesshin, but that even a good Sesshin usually has a shitty day. Or two. And you'd think, after all these years, you know, you'd think I'd like... I mean, and I do. I can navigate more when I recognize, you know, what's going on and what I need to let go of. And, like, usually there'll be, like, some kind of cool, spacious moment during meditation, and then, like, the next 24 to 48 hours of meditation stinks. And then I'll realize, oh, I'm just trying to make that happen again. Yeah, I mean, you know, it'd be like, duh, but it's just, it seems to be so what we do, right? It's kind of like, okay, I relax like this, I calm my mind, and then that cool thing happened. Like, so I'm going to do it again, right? But then there's just this expectation that some particular thing is going to happen. But then when I realize that, it's like, oh, ah. And, you know, then there's this kind of ease as I let that go too.
So renunciation is either one cause or the go on for me. How to give it all up in the midst of it all without ever turning your back, or trying to get a safe distance from it all.
Mm.
And your dharma often returns to great activity. Actually, it occurred to me today, you gotta have a samatha mantra around here somewhere. How much of great activity is dōmyō, and how much of it is just the way it ought to be? The way that your expression of freedom always results in great activity.
Mm-hmm.
Always, but yeah. So often, right? Is said several times in the course of your talk. Is there freedom that doesn't result in great activity, that goes in other directions? How much of that is particular to you?
Well,
I'm sure that the way my activity manifests is unique to me, but even a hermit on a mountaintop who has devoted himself to just being completely separate from society and just, you know, subsisting on a garden and meditating all the time, you know, is manifesting an activity, I guess. It's, you know, it's, I guess it's our response to having this life. How are, what choices are we going to make and how are we going to manifest? So yeah, I guess I would say that even the hermit on the mountaintop is engaging in great activity. It might not look as busy as my activity, but it's, yeah, I don't know if that makes sense.
Yes, thank you.
In a sense, it's that, how are we going to manifest in the relative world, which nobody gets an option not to do that. So even in a, you know, I mean, it's almost an illusion, really, that, you know, like the monk or someone in a monastery, and I have two people here who have spent a fair amount of time in a monastery today. Yeah, you don't escape the relative. I mean, you simplify things, perhaps. You renounce some things, but, I mean, it's like, in a way, maybe the sphere of your activity shrinks down to here, but it still feels like full activity. It completely, I mean, there's sometimes, like, I'll go now to session and, you know, there's these people who have lived out a great vow for, you know, since I was there, right? They largely have just been there doing their daily routine and, you know, doing session each month and all that. And there's a little part of me that just thinks, like, their life is so small, right? Like, oh, isn't that sweet? You've been here all this time. Well, I've been off doing all this. But for them, it doesn't feel like that. For them, their life feels complete. There's richness and interactions and decisions and responses and daily work. And
pursued various podcasts that wrestle in some way with the absolute and the relative. And sometimes I have the sense that I'm pursuing, grasping it. And then other times I'm thinking it's different than grasping it. But a lot of the time my goal is to grasp it. And then I have to really get that those two pieces to coincide in me, in my head, at the same time. And so I think it's somehow being able to make the space for that to drop away is part of what I have experienced a little smidgen of at the sessions that I've been to. But it isn't like an aha for me yet, that now I have understood it, and now forever after that I will be able to keep that.
Yeah.
It's more like a colander. It runs through or something. So
I mean, that's the whole process.
Voice coming from the speaker.
Oh. Who is it?
The whole process is mysterious, and part of my talk, which I kind of skipped over, was this. You know, it's very difficult not to just get attached to experiences or hope for experiences, and because I mean, you know, what else is it about? But but in a way, that's like, unfortunately, as soon as we, because like, what is it, faith in mind, the more you talk and think on this, the further from the truth you'll be. You know, we talk about absolute and relative, and your mental map, and so then we just make a mental map of practice. Like, there's me, and then there's something I haven't seen, and I need to see it, and if I see it, you know, this is what I need to do in order to see it and awaken to it, and then, I mean, and that's all, what's all a mental map, right? So now we're, no matter how hard we try, like, we're not there. We can't get there with a mental map. So how do we give that up and still make an effort, right? Because this isn't about just like, all right, well, I'm just going to go, like, get busy and what? So it's crazy making, but I think what I find inspiring is that the practice doesn't seem to have very much to do with those experiences, as lovely as they are, as inspiring as they are. I feel like this practice works on us. If we really give it the time and the space, it works on us at a physical level, a subconscious level, unconscious, whatever. And it transforms us whether we end up having these special experiences or not. That somehow it's recalibrating us, that we are doing a factory reset, even if we don't walk away going like, oh, and then I, you know, guess what I realized? That it, yeah, so it's I don't know, it's preparing the ground. And I guess the experience of, you know, when we do finally have some insight or experience that then we can talk to a teacher about and they go, yeah, that sounds like, you know, whatever. So some kind of thing that we can kind of hold on to or identify. My experience of that is that when that happens, it's like, oh, you mean that? Like, it's like you realize it's something that's just, it's been all there all along. It's just something subtle that you've dismissed or overlooked. So that's, at some point I realized, like, so I've never had a, like, Kensho experience of, like, you know, falling down, you know, dramatic, life-altering moment. And they do happen, not all that often, frankly. But that really tormented me for, you know, I was practiced for a long time, felt like I had really transformed my life, had plenty of insights, but, like, that thing, what is that thing? And then at a certain point, I realized, what do I really, really want that thing for? And I realized I wanted to be free from doubt. I wanted to know. And then I asked myself, well, do you doubt this? And I said, no, I don't. So, there you go. Maybe I'll have a dramatic experience someday, maybe I won't, but through, they sometimes talk about it like if you walk through the mist long enough, you get wet.
What did you mean by when you said you ask yourself, do you doubt this? What was this?
You know, that this that's beyond words, the you know, the thing that we can point at, the thing that, you know, gives the bodhisattva the joy and the strength and the resilience, the I guess, I mean, in the context of this talk, I would say, do I doubt the absolute aspect of reality?
How, without touching it, how do you not doubt it?
Well, I mean, you have touched it, like the mist. You're in it and around it, and see glimpses of it, and I don't know. So it's more of a gradual dawning than a, you know, a lightning strike. Mm-hmm. So it is a, it is a change, but it's just not one that you know you can point to like this. And because then I asked, like, well, do I want something to point to like that so I can brag about it? It's like, okay, I can let go of that, right? So, and unfortunately, I had teachers that were very, you know, Kyogen had a dramatic Kensho and Gyokoku didn't, and they both deeply respected one another's practice, and so I had that model of, you know, this is something that you don't know. It's something how your practice unfolds depends on a mysterious number of things. Your karma. You know, I've often felt like I have a very, and this is fortunate in a way, to some extent, our inability to really awaken to this, to really let go of our mental map, to some extent, that is a positive thing. To some extent, if we have a really whole and strong sense of self, and we're mentally pretty, you know, coherent and stable. Like our mind is a resilient thing that's not so ready to give up, which is actually can be a healthy thing. So I felt like my mind is always like, you know, like you get a little glimpse, boop, that's enough. Now we're going to integrate it. Don't want to do too much. Like it's taking care of me in a way. It's not letting me see too much at any given time, even though I'm like, come on, I want to just like break it open and see, like, you know. Because people who have had dramatic experiences, they're sometimes not all that pleasant. I mean, they're very traumatic as well. They leave people like wondering what on earth to do with themselves. And then they have to integrate that. So I feel like, so Kyogen called it a slowly opening lotus versus a lotus that goes, you know, so. All right, well, thank you all for coming. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.